Hi, everybody. I'm Brittany Lewis with Forbes Breaking News. Joining me now is Richard Goldberg, Senior Advisor at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Richard, thank you so much for joining me again.
Great to be back.
The past weekend marked the 6 months since Hamas launched their October 7th attack on Israel. So can you lay out where exactly we are in terms of this war?
Yeah, we step back and look at the 30,000-foot view. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, have dismantled a large percentage of Hamas's command and control in Gaza. Most of their battalions destroyed. There remain cells, obviously, throughout Gaza, both in the north, which we've seen pop up in central Gaza, and in southern Gaza. But as a fighting force, as a military force, mostly dismantled, if not destroyed, severely degraded, certainly in northern Gaza, in central Gaza, and now in Khan Yunis, the second largest city of Gaza, which is in the south. Now, the IDF has withdrawn most of its ground forces following a four-month battle in Khan Yunis, that second largest city there. That was formerly the home of Hamas's military leaders in Gaza, like Yahya Sinwar, Mohammed Deif, who we believe are hiding in the tunnel system between Khan Yunis and Rafah, the southernmost city. Rafah is that one city that still stands with total Hamas control. We believe the leaders underneath the city are still coordinating the war, other cells they may be in touch with elsewhere in Gaza. Four battalions of Hamas stand in Rafah itself. It's also the border with Egypt. And so we don't think about that border very often, though we should. People only talk about the Israeli border or the Mediterranean Sea. There is a southern border as well with Egypt, which is where we believe a lot of tunnels exist for smuggling of weapons, of people, of money, etc. And so we're now at a stage where obviously there is a focus on humanitarian efforts and stability in northern Gaza, ensuring that people are getting the food and the aid that we know has been surging into Gaza for weeks and months. Doing that in a way where Hamas cannot interfere with that aid distribution, that aid groups actually work with the IDF to get that done in a way that they haven't been willing to in the past. Also looking at what does an operation in Rafah look like. Obviously, Hamas does not fall in Gaza until Rafah is taken, until the tunnels, more importantly, under Rafah and between Rafah and Khan Yunis are dismantled and the leadership that is hiding down there are either captured or killed. We also have the hostages, right? At least 130 hostages still kept by Hamas. There are negotiations that have been going on for weeks, both in Doha, Qatar, and now in Cairo, Egypt, to try to get the hostages out. And what we see is Hamas now saying, we don't think we have enough living hostages to make a deal that the Israelis would find worthwhile. A very tragic statement, horrific statement to make, that they don't have 40 civilian hostages left to trade who are still alive. There's obviously a lot of soldiers as well who were captured on October 7th that they're not counting in that. They're not providing estimates on. We don't know if this is true or not, by the way. It could be psychological warfare by Hamas. But of course, the optics, not great for Israel today, I would say. Definitely looks like the United States bringing the hammer down, threatening to cut off U.S. military assistance to Israel, unless Israel starts playing by the Pentagon and the White House's view of the world, which is to go slower, not go into Rafah, wrap up military operations, potentially leaving Hamas intact in Gaza and not getting all the hostages back. So Israel has a real dilemma in front of it in Gaza itself. What will come next? Will there be a Rafah operation? What does that look like? Will they seal the border with Egypt as far as tunnels and smuggling go? Will they be able to stabilize northern Gaza and prove a concept of how to get aid not going through Hamas into people's hands, so that you can not just talk about the war and how the war wraps up with some sort of victory for Israel and defeat for Hamas, but what comes after that war in a non-Hamas governance where the people of Gaza take responsibility for themselves in a way that will not create a new platform for terror in the future.
So let's first start with Rafah. As we know, earlier, President Biden said that an invasion into Rafah would be a red line. Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't seem to agree. He said that, quote, no force in the world could stop an Israeli invasion into Rafah. So, and he said that a date has been set for that. Is there any indication of when that date would be?
Well, we don't know when that date would be. We also just don't know that there is a date. There's conflicting reports on there. The prime minister has said there is a date. There have been other leaks, reports that the defense minister said there isn't a date yet. So we don't really know exactly what's going on, if this is posturing or if this is a true military plan in place. I have heard from very high-level sources that whether there is a next step in Rafah or not, what we have seen over the last few days of the Israeli withdrawal from southern Gaza was pre-planned. Now, whether they were pre-planning it to happen on this Sunday at this time, immediately following a very tense phone call with the President of the United States, I find doubtful. But they said that once military objectives in Khan Yunis were reached, they would no longer need a massive ground force there. They could withdraw those forces, which include a lot of the commando special forces, to prepare for other battles to come, whether it's in Rafah, whether it's being sent back in for special operations like we saw at the Al-Shifa hospital, where hundreds of Hamas leaders had crept back in believing they could set up shop, but the Israelis actually saw it happening, laid a trap, and then had a surprise raid to get a lot of Hamas leaders that had tried to go back into the hospital. And so there also is obviously the possibility of forces being needed on the northern border, where Hezbollah out of southern Lebanon is attacking Israel on a daily basis, threatening to escalate. And they are keeping forces in central Gaza. There's one brigade that is taking control and keeping control of the major east-west highway that divides northern and southern Gaza, and then also some of the key patrol and convoy routes that you would need for aid distribution, both along the Mediterranean and along the border with Israel. So will there be a Rafah operation? How do we sort of put the president's, you know, claim of a red line and repeated statements now we've seen that there is complete opposition to any ground operation in Rafah, to the Israelis being very firm saying they can't have victory over Hamas without taking Rafah? Well, I think we need to go a little deeper here and try to sort out, is there a complete contradiction, or is this a lot of political positioning around trying to find a way of achieving the military objectives by other rhetoric, perhaps? What does Israel need to have happen in order to have a military operation successful in Rafah? Well, the civilian population needs to clear out as much as possible. Well, you have not just the population of Rafah, you have the million Palestinians who moved from northern Gaza all the way south towards Rafah by this point in the war, because the Israelis started in northern Gaza and moved their way south. And it's been a big concern to the Biden administration, and quite frankly, the Israelis as well. How do you begin this operation without evacuating so many people, and where will they go? Well, if Israel has wrapped up most of its ground operations in southern Gaza, withdrawn its forces, it is possible to see the natural flow of population start heading back north in a controlled manner, in a screening that is controlled by the IDF to make sure Hamas does not go with that population flow. And that's a big, big caveat. There's also the potential to give more room for people to go into Khan Yunis or to go into other areas that the IDF might facilitate evacuations, without any hindrance of the IDF being there, any threat of being hit accidentally by a strike against Hamas on your way of evacuating. So Israel is facilitating in some ways the beginning stages of what could be an evacuation, whether it's natural, we would call it evacuation, it's just simply people returning out of Rafah, or an actual evacuation. The next piece, you can't take Rafah without securing its southern flank with Egypt. Obviously, that's a fallback position. That's an escape position for Hamas. That is a resupply potential through the smuggling in the tunnels there. And so some plan needs to be achieved that Egypt buys into, potentially, with U.S. support, for the IDF to take that key corridor that separates Rafah and Egypt right there. They call it the Philadelphia Corridor. You'll hear about that in the news in the coming weeks. And then the last piece is Israel needs to get up the tunnels. And that's where I think it's hard to imagine you can't have a conflict over Rafah that doesn't involve people in Rafah fighting, not just the four battalions that are in Rafah, but getting at the tunnel infrastructure that is underneath Rafah. That's where I don't see how you can square the circle. If it's going to remain a president's red line that the IDF can't enter Rafah in a ground operation, then you're never going to get the Hamas leaders and you're never going to get the hostages.
I am curious, let's say there is a ground operation in Rafah, what that does to U.S.-Israel relations, because Senator Chris Coons, a close Biden ally, said this in an interview over the weekend, quote, "I think we are at the point where President Biden has said, and I have said, and others have said, if Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, were to order the IDF into Rafah at scale, they were to drop 1,000-pound bombs and send in a battalion to go after Hamas and make no provision for civilians or for humanitarian aid, that I would vote to condition aid to Israel." And in a speech last month, as I'm sure you know, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called for new elections in Israel and argued that Netanyahu, quote, lost his way and the nation, quote, cannot survive if it becomes a pariah. So where do you think U.S.-Israel relations are now and if there is an invasion in Rafah?
Well, I think there's two separate things going on here. So for Senator Coons' statement, there's a lot of caveats in there. So if Israel, as would be the plan, helps stage and enable a major evacuation of civilians and lays out very precise goals of how it's going to achieve military objectives in a way that tries to minimize civilian casualties as much as possible, which, by the way, is what they have done everywhere they have gone so far, which has been something that has been verified and backed up by the Biden administration at every step. And you listen to John Kirby at a press conference. He always says Israel has taken overwhelming steps to try to reduce, minimize civilian casualties. There's no evidence of a war crime. There's no evidence of genocide. All of this stuff is politics and delegitimization of Israel by Hamas and its supporters. And so long as Israel does all the things it already is going to do and should be doing, then according to Senator Coons, he should be supporting Israel fully in going into Rafah thereafter. I mean, there is this sort of straw man argument that a Rafah operation is going to be like the Dresden bombing or something. It's just not going to be like that. It hasn't been anywhere else today. So, so it's a matter of the fact there's a lot of civilians there and you do need time for civilians to leave. That could take a month or more just by itself without even having the ground operation. And I think the Israelis know that. The Americans certainly know that. But obviously, we're also in a different context, and that's where you get to Senator Schumer's speech. And you get to the rhetoric that has been completely over the top from the Biden administration. What I would call sustained political warfare by the White House and the State Department against the state of Israel for weeks, alongside continued military assistance. Why is that happening? Well, obviously the president is under immense pressure from a very radical left wing. That is essentially pro-Hamas, in my view. You see them out in the streets. They're worried about a handful, a few thousand votes, and maybe in Dearborn, Michigan, or elsewhere, this uncommitted vote that they've seen from these radical progressives in other states that they believe they're protesting Biden's support for Israel. That's what they're focused on. That's what they're responding to. They shouldn't be. It's very short-sighted. But unfortunately, that's exactly what we see going on here. And so I think that if we understand that there's a political dance the White House is doing, so long as they don't actually cut off assistance, so long as they actually stay inside a political dance of rhetoric, I don't like it. I think it's horrific. I think it's doing damage to the U.S.-Israel relationship. I think it's doing damage to the future of the Democratic Party and its support for Israel in a way that the president doesn't even appreciate. But if he doesn't actually cut off assistance, and the Israelis do go forward in a staged way that they were already planning to, with U.S. support, to finally take out Hamas eventually in Rafah and then be able to move into a post-war stability operation and a non-Hamas governance, this still works according to Israeli plans. And so would I think it would be better for the President of the United States to simply say every single day, October 7th happened, Hamas started this war, Hamas is a terrorist organization, Hamas is holding hostages, Hamas uses human shields, Israel is a democracy, Israel abides by the law of war, Israel is not committing a genocide, stop saying that, that's a blood libel. Yes, I wish he would say that. I think he'd get a lot more votes than whatever he thinks he's doing. But that is not the president we have at this time. And so from a security situation, an outcome-based approach on the ground, for not just Israel's security, but in my view, our long-term security in the region. So long as Israel does move forward and finds a way with U.S. support, military support, to take out Hamas in Rafah while stabilizing the rest of Gaza and moving to that post-war Gaza without Hamas, there is still hope. It's still light at the end of the tunnel.
Then what do you think President Biden's point in saying an invasion in Rafah is a red line? Because you are right. October 7th, October 8th, President Biden did say the United States stands firmly with Israel. 6 months out, there does seem to be a little bit of a political dance here because, as you said, he's facing political pressure. He has gotten those uncommitted protest votes. So do you ever see a time where United States aid to Israel will be conditional?
I hope not. I would oppose it. I fear that you do see this being mainstreamed in the Democratic Party. You have folks like Senator Chris Van Hollen who have been pushing for this for a long time, predating October 7th. And so it's not just the squad anymore. It's not just Bernie Sanders. This is becoming a little bit more mainstream and acceptable within the Democratic Party to push for this. I think important for people to understand a few things. Number one, all of our foreign assistance is conditional to all countries. We already have built into law requirements that our aid must be used in compliance with international law, with humanitarian law, cannot be used to conduct human rights abuses, can't be provided to a country that experiences a coup, things of that nature. I worked on foreign assistance oversight for many years on Capitol Hill. The idea that we need to add additional conditions on Israel is completely political and intended to weaponize, basically the BDS movement, the boycott movement of Israel, into our foreign assistance to try to pressure Israel into making moves that are against its security interest, which, by the way, means, in my view, it's against our security interest by making Israel more vulnerable and weaker in a very dangerous region where they are a bulwark of democracy on the front lines for fighting the same kind of people we're fighting, the intelligence that they share with the United States, the counterterrorism cooperation we have. People seem to have just woken up and forgotten all about it, let alone the technological cooperation we have that benefits us, the threats we share from Iran, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihadism, radical Sunni Islamism, all these things. So going ahead and trying to put more pressure on Israel when Israel is the democratic ally that we have. And by the way, which one of these senators is standing up to condition aid to Ukraine? Not a single one. Not a single one. And that to me shows exactly what the game is here. It's not about their concern over human rights. It's not about their concern for international law. It's a political agenda to attack Israel, to delegitimize Israel, instead of lining up, as I believe Republicans and Democrats should, behind democratic allies that are under siege and under attack.
I want to now look at negotiations. Hamas officials and Israeli officials met in Cairo over the weekend. Can you characterize how these talks went?
Yeah, not well, basically, is the bottom line. And it's not surprising they haven't gone well. I think we've talked about this many times in the past that we've had these conversations, and I hate to sound like a broken record. Hamas took a lot of hostages on October 7th. That's their leverage. And then they use various tools to pressure Israel into a premature end to the war so that Hamas survives without giving up its leverage. But they have that leverage in reserve if ever they come to a judgment call that their survival is finally endangered, in doubt. And so we saw early on, during major IDF operations, when Hamas needed a break, Hamas needed to be able to get resupplies, a surge of aid into Gaza that they could take advantage of, that they needed to move around, reposition, maybe even reposition hostages. They negotiated one ceasefire, giving up X number of hostages, knowing they had a lot more to go. And they have not gone back to any sort of negotiated ceasefire since then, because even though the IDF has continued to advance, they have believed that the growth of international pressure on Israel every week since has brought them much closer to their victory. And their victory is not all of them survive. They have 50% of a fighting force. They have 25% of a fighting force. They only have one city left in Gaza. Their victory is that they're still there breathing. Their victory is that they can rebuild, that the Israelis withdraw, that they lose, that there will be in the future, whether it's in a week, in a year, or 10 years, another opportunity to massacre on a scale of October 7th and be part of the Iranian ring of fire around Israel. That's the victory. So only when they come close to actual defeat will they be willing to agree to some sort of ceasefire that benefits them, to take a break, that could become a longer ceasefire. Right now, they have the President of the United States threatening a cutoff of military assistance on a phone call with the Prime Minister of Israel. They have the United States allowing UN Security Council resolutions that are one-sided, that are biased towards Israel, towards Hamas, to go through the Security Council. They are absolutely not concerned at the moment with giving up any leverage and agreeing to a ceasefire. The actual sort of bottom line on the battlefield right now is Israel has unilaterally agreed to an effective ceasefire, with exceptions of precision strikes that are going to be carried out on a day-to-day basis as targets become available. But they've already withdrawn the major ground operations. They've already halted major ground operations. So what is Hamas really battling for? More aid into Gaza that they can try to take advantage of? That's happening under U.S. and international pressure. What else would they want? They want the movement of civilians back from the south to the north. They want to be able to embed in population flows to go from Rafah all the way back to the north so they can take back real command and control in central and northern Gaza. This is a major point of contention at the table right now. Hamas is saying no deal unless everyone can just go freely with no IDF interference from Rafah, from the south to the north, crossing that line where I said the IDF still holds, that east-west highway. And the IDF is saying no. Women and children might be able to go north, but they'll still have to go through IDF screenings. And as far as male potential combatants go, they're not coming north quite yet. And at some point, when we're ready for males to come back, they can go through proper screening to make sure they're not actually Hamas terrorists that are coming back north. That's a non-starter for Hamas. And they feel no pressure to say yes at the moment until they get this or something close to it that they can take advantage of and exploit. So look for that being one of the major flashpoints. They're also squeezing the Israelis for more and more terrorists to release for propaganda purposes, for security threat purposes. Not just the number of terrorists to be released in exchange for every hostage, but the kind of terrorist. What did they do? Why were they convicted? How many people did they kill? What's the propaganda value of each of these prisoners that's going to be released from an Israeli jail? That's also something that is under contention here at the negotiating table. And finally, are they going to continue to insist that all Israeli forces must leave, that even that one brigade that's left must withdraw from Gaza? That is their stated position right now. And the Israelis are saying, no, we're not gonna do that. We're gonna stay in position to collect intelligence and perform special operations and reserve the right to re-enter anywhere we go for a major operation in the future or for stability operations like we may see in the north in coming days and weeks. For Hamas, that's a non-starter. Again, what would it take for Hamas to say, okay, we'll take less than our full maximalist demands? A real credible threat that the IDF is restarting some significant operation to finally dismantle them and take them out of business in Gaza and to replace them in Gaza. Once they believe that is a viable path, that that actually could start or is starting to happen, then I think you see movement. Until then, I really fear that the U.S. pressure, the international pressure, the optics, all driven by our domestic politics, whether or not the U.S. actually cuts off military assistance doesn't matter, because optics are what matter. Perception is what matter. Perception is reality. And it doesn't just matter for those Hamas leaders in the tunnels. It matters for the threat from Hezbollah in the north. And it matters ultimately for what the Ayatollah thinks is happening in Tehran.
So as we sit here 6 months out, negotiations aren't going well. U.S.-Israel relations are somewhat fraught, and there is a looming potential Rafah ground invasion. So what specifically are you looking out for next in the upcoming days, the upcoming weeks?
So a few things. Number one, I think it's to the IDF's advantage to partner with non-Hamas-aligned, non-governmental organizations who would be willing to work with the IDF for the distribution of aid in Gaza. That has been a source of tension. It is the idea that UN organizations have refused to coordinate with the IDF. Even in some cases, people might be surprised by this, World Central Kitchen Obviously, a horrific tragedy that happened, but there are truths that people need to know of certain NGOs that refuse to coordinate with the IDF in a way that provides deconfliction and potential augmented security for the distribution of assistance, because they don't want to be seen as in any way siding with Israel on the ground in Gaza. They have no problem coordinating with Hamas in some cases, but coordinating with the IDF would be some sort of a sin for their humanitarian neutrality badge. That has to change. And so to the extent the IDF can be involved in stability operations in northern Gaza, I think helps fight the propaganda, the disinformation campaign that Hamas has launched with a lot of willing accomplices in the NGO and UN community. I think we will see additional special operations planned, certain targeted strikes that we have not seen before, that I think will hopefully reassert that the IDF plan of removing major ground operations, major ground forces, but leaving contingencies for surgical strikes is paying off, like the surprise raid at Al-Shifa Hospital. And as they have these surprise raids and surgical strikes, and perhaps capture more Hamas operatives, they learn more intelligence that informs their next missions. But ultimately, I think we do need to see a process in play moving forward for how Rafah will be dealt with, how they will dismantle the tunnel infrastructure under Rafah, destroy the four remaining battalions there, and secure the border between Egypt and Rafah. And that really can't be put off, because the longer that conversation is put off, the more Hamas will be emboldened and believe their days are not numbered, that they are in fact the ones slated for victory, not the Israelis.
Richard Goldberg, per usual, I really am so grateful for your expertise here. Thank you so much for joining me.
You bet.